Hey everyone, welcome to episode 20 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. If this is your first time listening, thanks for tuning in. The Historic Performance Podcast is typically published every Tuesday and Thursday, except this week we only have a publication on Tuesday. Notes from today's show can be found at www.historicperformance.net/podcast. You can connect with me via Twitter at Historic Perform. There I publish all the latest episodes and give you the opportunity to ask questions to future guests. In today's episode, I chat with Chris Wright. Chris Wright is the U21 sports scientist at Birmingham City. Within today's podcast, we discuss a variety of topics, including relationship management, player load monitoring, and advice that he has for young strength and conditioning coaches just starting out their career. It's an episode full of information. I think you're going to really enjoy it. Let's get the show started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I have Chris Wright. Chris, how's it going?
I'm very good. Yourself?
I'm doing very well, Chris. Just to get us started, can you give us a little background information about yourself, education, and how you've gotten to your current role?
Yeah, no problem. If I start at the very beginning, I was probably about 14 years of age when I realized that I was never going to be a professional footballer. Realized that I wanted to be in professional sport. So then kind of started that journey to try and work out what I needed to achieve to fulfill a dream of working in sport, basically. So from that point, I studied A-levels in kind of biology, PE, got the grades to then go to the University of Birmingham to study sport and exercise science. And then from there, got in at Birmingham City Football Club working as their under-18s sports scientist and have been there since and progressed there since. I started my kind of soccer coaching badges as soon as I could. So at the time, you had to be 16 to start your FA level 2 and 18 to start your B license. So did those as soon as I could, and then did my A license whilst I was at the University of Birmingham. So I kind of achieved that by the time I was in my early 20s, really. Yeah, and that's about it, really.
So initially, how did you come up with the position at Birmingham City?
It was just through opportunity more than anything. The season before, I'd been coaching part-time with their under-11s. And there was a situation where the under-18 sports scientist at the time went to work with the Birmingham City's first team. So they were shorthanded. So I helped out a bit. Wrote some off-season programs, helped out with a few sessions, that kind of thing. They advertised for the job externally. I applied for it because I already knew from the kind of what the role involved and the staff and the players. They took me on from there. So it was purely because of being involved as a coach that I was just in the right place at the right time to take the opportunity.
At least from my understanding, talking to other people on this podcast, each club may have different departments. And so how does it work in Birmingham City? Do you have a strength and conditioning department, a sports science department, or are they combined?
No, it's combined, really. At our club, it's not a sports scientist covers a whole kind of manner of sins. So kind of fitness and conditioning out on the grass, data analysis from GPS, heart rates, and then kind of traditional S&C-based work. Within our sports science department, we've got head of department in Dave Carolan. He's a first-team sports scientist in Tom Page. I work with the 21s. We have a guy that works with our under-18s, a fella called Elliot Woolmer, and then there's a guy that works with our schoolboys, Andy Cunningham. And that's kind of the sports science department. We're all called sports scientists. There's no specific strength and conditioning coach. And then we work with a with the physiotherapy department, basically. So you get in at our club, you're almost responsible for your team. So rather than having a guy that is the strength and conditioning coach for everybody or is the fitness coach for everybody, you have your group of players that you're responsible for. And that works quite well. It enabled to us to, so you have a handle on all your players. So you know what work they're doing in the gym. You know the work they're doing out on the grass. You know how long they played on in the last game. So how much work they need to do the following day. So it just saves bits of information being missed in kind of passing over. So if I was a fitness coach and then trying to relay that to the strength and conditioning coach that the lads have worked quite hard out on the grass or they needed to do more of this, less of this, it saves on that because you have a handle on everything.
Do you also find that you have a better relationship with the technical staff?
I think you do because you're always there. You're kind of the go-to guy. And there's not lots of people feeding in different bits of information. So if you have a technical coach and if there's only one person going to speak to that coach, it makes the information being passed on a lot easier rather than a fitness coach goes and says a little bit, strength and conditioning goes and sees a little bit, physio goes to say a little bit. So the message can get lost a little bit if there's people, lots of people feeding in. Whereas if you've got one person that's going to that coach, it makes it a little bit easier. It makes it a lot easier in my job because I've known our under 21s coach for a long time. We've worked together for a while. So we know how each other work. I know what he wants to get out of training. He knows what I want training to be without a kind of a real in-depth conversation about it. Because we've kind of built up a relationship over time.
Yeah, and I've definitely noticed that on my end, the more time that you've been spending with someone, the better you get to know them. And in essence, you end up as well getting a better feel of what they're looking for in terms of fitness, in terms of strength and conditioning. So it really helps the process.
Yeah, 100%.
While you were at the University of Birmingham, you were the head men's football coach there. Can you tell us a little information about that?
Yeah, I started off working with the second team when I was in my first year because I wanted to kind of to do more coaching and plus to do your A license in the UK, you need to be working with coaching 11v11. So I did a season working with the second and third team, and then in my third year, I started as head coach. And that was a really good experience for me because it allowed me to get a handle on relationships and kind of and how you deal with different people in different situations. And it gives you an appreciation for the stresses, as it were, that are put on the coach in terms of getting results, in terms of managing players, in terms of preparing players, play against specific teams, so adopting different formations, different tactics, depending on your opposition. So I found that as a really good grounding. And it was it kind of prepared me for the worst, having about a 90-man squad to look after because we had three teams. So we had a lot of players signed up at in the first team. At the time, we were in the Northern Premiership. For that, so we probably had two or three players that were a conference standard football wise and players that had been in full-time football and then unfortunately been released, so came to university to get an education but also wanted to play football. So it was quite a good standard of players to work with at that level and at that time for me.
How did you find the transition where you're coming from the University of Birmingham being more in a manager position than going to Birmingham City as a sports scientist?
At the time, I didn't find it that challenging. I personally enjoy working as a sports scientist more than a coach because it gives you a greater opportunity to build relationships and interact with people. I found that as a coach, when you're seen as a strong decision-making role, it's as much trying to manage people. Sometimes you got to keep guys at arm's length. Sometimes you need to put your arm around them. Sometimes they don't want to speak to you. So it's a lot. It's very different from a kind of a social standpoint. And I mean that in terms of the relationship with the players. But it did make it easier for me going into as a sports scientist, because you always already had that appreciation of the demands that the coach was under, and you also had the appreciation of how to manage players in different ways, because getting guys to do certain work, some guys need to be cajoled into it, other guys need to be kind of teased into doing the work, some people need to understand why they're doing the work. It was good in terms of that I had the appreciation and the understanding of the different mentalities of different types of people.
One of the key questions, and it happens in many leagues throughout the world, is that you're dealing with a variety of nationalities. I'm sure with Birmingham City, at least in the first team, I'm not necessarily sure about the U21. I'm pretty sure the U21 is fairly homogenous in terms that they're majority of them are English. But if you've had any exposure to the first team at all, is there any issues in terms of strength and conditioning background coming from different cultures?
From the guys that we've come across, not really. It depends a great deal more on what clubs they've been at, because different clubs have different cultures regards strength and conditioning or fitness and conditioning. So you almost have to be mindful. So I know kind of a 21s level, if we take a player from Club X, I know that they're going to be able to do X, Y, and Z. If I know they've come from Club B, then they may not be able to do X, Y, and Z, because that's not part of their work. That's not part of their kind of physical syllabus, as it were. From a personality point of view, and in terms of a desire to work, there's a bit of a cultural difference, but on the whole, most players are pretty, in the last kind of 5 to 10 years, most players have got a decent level of competency from a strength and conditioning point, coming into whether it be first team football or under 21s football.
For the under 21 players, what type of data are you collecting in order to manage player load?
We use heart rate monitors, and we use GPS, and we use few metrics. So we use Catapult GPS, and that's a great bit of software for me, because it gives you everything. It gives you the kind of the whole picture of everything, and then you can delve as deep into it as you want to go and manipulate it however you want it, in terms of feedback. But it gives you so many variables. I think it's really important to get variables that mean something to your players, but also mean something to your coaching staff, because it can be very difficult and sometimes maybe intimidating if you come to your coach and you're giving him 15 variables every day and he only understands two of them. So I made a point of going to our coach at the start of the season and saying, right, this is all the information that I can give you. What information do you want? What information means something to you? So a variable like meters per minute is the same as total distance fundamentally. But to the coach, who's kind of he's an endurance guy. So 8K means far more to him than 62 meters a minute. Yep. So then that meant that the information I gave him was total distance, because he understood what total distance was and it meant something to him, rather than a different variable, which is fundamentally the same thing.
Yeah, and that makes total sense, because you don't want to burden them with data that's not necessary for them to know. And at the same time, you want them to tell you what is important to them so that they can manipulate what they're doing in terms of a technical session standpoint.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's also really important that you're able to speak the coach's language. And I'm not pretending to be some kind of horse whisperer here, but you have to put things in a way that the coach understands. And that varies from coach to coach. some coaches might have a very scientific knowledge, so want all the scientific, the high speed distance and the meters per minute. Another may not be, so you've got to take that information and relate verbally to them. And that's kind of something that we've taken on board with regards to the reports that we do. You know, we produce a report to give to the coach so that he can look back on things and he can look at it and ask questions about it later. But more importantly is the conversation you have with the coach about the players, about the training. And it could just be as little as kind of a sentence that when you've got a good relationship with a coach or when you understand each other, means far more than 20 numbers on a page.
Absolutely. Beyond that, when you're collecting all these metrics via Catapult, how do you use that in order to formulate your strength and conditioning sessions?
Do you mean strength and conditioning in the gym or out on the grass?
Well, let's actually try covering both, if it's at all possible.
No, of course. We'll go gym-based first. So if we did a session that we saw the players covered a lot of high speed distance or a lot of sprint distance, that would affect what we did in the gym from a kind of a hamstring exercise point of view, because we look at that sprint distance, high speed distance, and see that we kind of from an injury prevention or from a health hamstring health point of view, we've got enough work into them to maintain the hamstring's performance. So then to go in the gym and do good mornings or straight leg deadlifts or something like that, that's going to load the hamstrings, might actually be detrimental. The same if there was a session that was a lot of kind of short, sharp or small sided type gains, which may have been more kind of quad dominant. We look to maybe balance that off the different ways. So we might see the need to do more hamstring based work and things along that line. From on the field point of view, we've got, we set targets, weekly targets to basically for a certain level of exposure for key variables. So from that point of view, it might get towards the end of the week and we might see that, okay, player A is not tick the boxes in terms of this variable. So we then go to that player with that information and go, okay, I'm going to need you to do a bit of extra work at the end of the training today because you've not ticked these boxes for us. Because the last thing we want to do is let that you get almost a detraining effect to go, okay, well, he's not done that much that week, that much that week. Well, if this keeps going, it's going to be even riskier for him from an injury point of view and also from a fitness point of view to be able to deal with the demands of training. Because especially at a 21s level, we're trying to prepare the players to play at a first team level. And it's very difficult to replicate first team training without first team players. So we have to get that work in other areas.
Absolutely. And I think that's also a fantastic transition into talking about how do you prepare players for championship level football from a physical standpoint?
It's very difficult, but because what we find from a data point of view is a player that's very comfortable, for, say a centre half, for example, in the under 21s might be very comfortable. It's not particularly stressful. So then he goes into a first team training session and that session then becomes very stressful for him. So it's almost about preparing the players to be as robust as they can to deal with that stress when they're called upon to either train with the first team or be on the bench for the first team or play for the first team. The last thing we want is a player to get the opportunity to be in the first team, but then break down after 3 or 4 days or weeks. So a main area is we look for them to be strong from a weight room standpoint. So when I speak to my guy who works with the under 18s, I'll give him kind of targets for the under 18s to be at. So that when they come into the 21s, I know that they're capable of dealing with what goes on in the gym and also what goes out on the grass. And then the same with the 21s players, we'll have a bare minimum requirement and we're always trying to push them up to get as high as they can. And then the same with with training. We try and make it as tough as we can for the 21s, push them as hard as they can without obviously risking them from an injury standpoint. So that at least if they go into a first team environment, they're fit enough to compete with their counterpart, or fitter than their championship playing counterpart. So then that allows them to hopefully perform better in training.
Without getting into specifics of exactly what your targets are at Birmingham City, what more or less should be the average strength markers that you're looking for someone who's at the U21 level and thinking about transitioning to playing to championship football?
Okay. Well, we break our lifts down to double leg strength, single leg strength, triple extension lifts, and then upper body pushes and pulls, either horizontally or vertically. So then we have, the 18s that are coming into the 21s need to be above the bottom kind of 20% historically. So over the past, we've got data over the past 5 or 6 years to go, okay, well, when these guys come in at under 21s, this is on average our bottom 20%. So we're looking for them to be above that. So from an 18 coming to a 21, we basically want them to be able to handle their body weight. So can you do pull-ups? Can you bench press your body weight, for example? Can you squat your body weight, split squat? We're happy for that to be kind of below body weight because it's a single leg activity, but that kind of work. And then you're looking to progress that up to just to be able to tolerate as much stress as possible as you go over. So we've got guys that can, at the minute, that can comfortably squat twice their body weight to parallel. Now, I'm not saying that's right, and that's just kind of my opinion, but that's the kind of the level we're trying to work them at. Because when we did a bit of internal research in terms of trying to quantify plyometrics, and we found that when players were jumping and landing on a force platform, they were able to tolerate a landing force of 7.5 times their body weight. So if that's the kind of the stress that they're going through when they're sprinting about the pitch, when they're jumping and landing, then we best make them as robust as we possibly can to deal with that stress.
Yeah, and I think that also correlates with a lot of the studies that are coming out of Australia when it looks at what are specific strength metrics for football players and how it reduces injury. And I think Garrison Draper, who was on here during the first episode, he's with the Philadelphia Union Major League Soccer. He mentioned that something that they ideally strive for is double body weight squat. And generally, they have found that people who can double body weight squat tend to be more resilient to injury based on the information that they have gathered.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't disagree. I think from a lot of the research, especially like you say in Australia and things that are coming out the AFL, especially tolerating things like repeated sprints, repeated high intensity efforts, that's really important for us. To in terms of playing at a championship level, which is a very physically demanding level of football, arguably more physically demanding than the Premiership is. Championship, you have far less time on the ball. You're expected to press harder. You're expected to play games. Our first team went through playing 7 games in 21 days. So you're expected to deal with that level of stress. So you've got to be as strong as you possibly can. I think when you get to a 32-year-old pro that's played over 500 games, does he need to be able to squat 2 times his body weight? I don't think so, because he's got that training history and he's got that robustness and his body's used to dealing with it. When you've got a 19-year-old player that's then being suddenly asked to make that step up, they need enough in the tank to be able to tolerate that. What we found is players who haven't had that level of strength basis of then when they've gone into the first team, it's been very bitty for them because they might have played, they play a game, they've got tight calves because they've got tired, so then they've missed training, then they've been prepared for the next game, etc. So then it leads to a bit of a vicious circle of just being preparing to play, not actually getting any fit or any stronger, and then at an increased risk of breaking down. So if we can kind of alleviate that that risk so that your calves may get tired, but not to the point where you've got to miss training in 2 days' time, then that's what we're going to try and strive for. We're at a situation where it's something that we've started doing from the research that we've seen, and we really need to quantify it ourselves in-house in terms of kind of internal studies, which we look to do with our undergrad and master's students, to actually put kind of pen to paper and prove what we're doing is the right thing to do, like you said, with the players, that if they can deal with twice their body weight, then they're at less risk of a soft tissue injury.
Yeah, and not saying, and I think the important part right here is to put these scientific studies in context, because yeah, obviously there's something that has been happened within this study, but then you need to see if it's going to translate well to your specific team, whether it comes from a cultural point of view that you're club has a certain mindset that may not necessarily correlate well with that, because obviously you always have to respect the coach's decision ultimately. Some coaches, you know, they have different ideas in terms of strength and conditioning. But beyond that, it's also understanding, you know, where your players are at in terms of their training age, understanding where your players are in terms of their injury history, because not every single movement is going to work for every single player.
No, I'd agree with you. We've tried to set up in terms of preparing players for the work that we're asking them to do by the time they get to 21s in the gym, is they start at 14 in terms of kind of movement preparation or learning the techniques. So like I said, I kind of speak to our under 18s guy and just, okay, I need these guys to be able to do 5 chin-ups, squat their body weight, etc. Those kind of competencies then get passed down to a 16. Well, our main thing might just be, right, well, we need you to squat to parallel for 8 repetitions, just using your body weight, as in no additional load, in the hope that if we can educate them in the right movement patterns at a younger age, then by the time they get to a 21s level, they're competent on kind of 4 or 5 key lifts, and then you can really kind of work to make people stronger. I think I've been fortunate this season with the first team manager that's kind of said that I'm happy for these guys that if they might miss technical sessions to then do strength sessions, because that's what this group of players need, then that's what will then he's happy for that to happen. Which makes things a lot easier if you have that level of buy-in from your first team coach.
Beyond that, the other question that I had is the U21s, how often are they playing?
We're trying to have a period that they at least play once a week. And then we try to do periods which replicate the demands of a first team schedule. So every now and again, we'll then try to play with a first team player, you might be asked to play on a Tuesday, then play again on a Saturday, then play again on the following Tuesday. And within that, you might have a 300 mile kind of trip to an away game. So we try and replicate that the best we can, just to expose the players to it, not only physically, but mentally, what it's like to spend that much time traveling, and how they try and manage their sleep, their eating, their nutrition in that situation.
When it comes to, I believe you just mentioned that the first team had to play 7 matches in 21 days.
Yeah.
In a situation like that, how much gym-based work can you actually do, if any?
It's limited because of obviously the demand that's put on the players. What you tend to do is not have much opportunity for work that's additional load. For example, squats and things like that. A lot of the work is injury prevention or prehabilitation based, kind of low intensity. So it's less intensity. Some might be a little bit voluminous, but on the whole, it's quite low. So it's like a maintenance load of some exercises. There is then you, a lot of your resisted work would be upper body wise. And then you'd be looking to get hold and manage your players that aren't playing. So you might play that. You might have the same guys sat on the bench for those seven games. So it's then how do you manage them? Because they're not getting the stimulus of playing. It's how you get, how you try and replicate that without overloading them, because obviously you want them to be fresher than the guys that are starting in all of those matches.
When you're creating gym-based sessions and also on-the-field sessions from a fitness standpoint, yep, are you programming on an individual basis, positional, or is it just an overall program for the entire team?
It's very difficult in an individual sport, in a team sport, to program for an individual, especially on the grass when it's a group training session. So if you've got 20 players in a training session and you've got to prepare them or warm them up for that training session, you tend to treat all 20 players the same, unless you're in the fortunate situation where you've got three or four staff and then you can kind of split them off into different groups. At the end of training, in terms of additional conditioning, this is out on the grass. If a player's, say you've got those players that have been sat on the bench, so you treat those a little bit differently because they've got a smaller group. So you might have specific conditioning for players that are fullbacks because your manager might need them to be bombing forward, overlapping the winger. So you need them to still have the capacity to do that work, whereas your centre half doesn't need that capacity. He might need the capacity to make short, sharp, lateral, forwards, backwards, jumping movements. So you condition him in that vein. So you're conditioning them more specifically for their position. In a gym-based environment, a lot of it is, at the minute, is kind of quite generic compound movements, because what works for, so squats, from a research standpoint, it seems to correlate well with jumping performance and correlate well with sprint performance. So that kind of, that ticks that box. There's not a great need to individualize strength or gym programs to outside the group. You do get situations where different players have different needs. So some players might be needing to put on kind of upper body mass, so they're program may lean towards that way. You might be looking for players to develop just leg strength to tolerate a workload. You might be looking them for produce a ratio of force development or more horizontal force than vertical. So that would affect your programming a little bit more. So that's more players' needs rather than the positional need.
The other question that I have is, beyond catapult, beyond your heart rate monitors, do you also use wellness questionnaires with your players?
Yes. I'll be honest, we haven't used them this season. I've used them in the past with, it's a lot of the time for me, it's in that situation, it depends on the quality of your software package. So it's fantastic if you can afford to get a bespoke program, have iPads in the changing room so they can fill that information out. Relay it back to an office and that gets processed. I've used a far cheaper version in terms of kind of Google questionnaires. So Google's got a questionnaire setting, so you can set that up with the players so they can fill that up. That's free, but as a result becomes a little bit more time consuming because you've got to process the data. So if you've got a few guys within looking after your team, then that's easier to manage. If you're a one-man band, that's quite difficult. Within the academy, we have a software package called the PMA. They have a questionnaire system built into that, so we've used that in the past. And I think the wellness questionnaires they're important. But the cheapest thing you can do, and probably the best thing you can do, is just speak to the players, because you get a far better feeling for how hard training was, how they're feeling. And also it allows you an opportunity to build relationships with the players that are in your group and start to learn what motivates them, what kind of people they are, to then try and get the best out of them. Sometimes it's quite difficult if you've got these questionnaires set up, then you've got this iPad system. So then it removes that question of how you're feeling today. And then you've got nowhere to start a conversation with a player. So you lose that in. Because if you've got these systems set up and you go, how are you? They can just flippantly say, well, check the iPad. And that's the end of the conversation. There's no way of building a relationship with a player. And like I alluded to at the start, I think it's important that you have those relationships so you can get the best out of the guys that you've got so they can get the best results for themselves and the team.
When we're talking about creating relationships and creating rapport, I think this is a really tough thing for especially younger coaches. They've just come out of university. They've read everything in the book. They think that they know everything. They're pumped up for their first job opportunity or internship, and then they find it difficult to relate to players. What would be some strategies that you used when you were younger in order to help create those relationships?
I'll be honest with you, I've made a ton of mistakes like that. And I think to an extent, you have to make those mistakes to learn from them. So I've made the mistake of kind of challenging a coach with 20 years experience when I had about two and just kind of rolled in and said, no, I don't think we should be doing that. Well, why not? Was his response. And then from that point, you damage your relationship. I think a lot of the time, the best thing you can do is sit back and take everything in and look at it from the coach's perception and speak to them and see what they're trying to find out and never really put the coach or the person you're trying to speak to in a defensive position. Never back them into a corner. So if I come straight for you and go, why are you doing that? Suddenly you're defensive. And then that relationship between you and I is then negative because I only cause you problems. I come and question what you're doing. Whereas if I approach it a different way and just come up to you and rather than going, why are you doing that? Pointing my finger at you. If you then go up and say, can you just explain that to me? Because I didn't see all of it and I'm just curious. And then you can build an understanding from that person's point of view. You can try and build a relationship with them. And then you can kind of, you can open dialogue up that way. So I guess my advice would be to always stop and think before you go into to argue or to say you disagree with something or even say you agree with something. Just stop and think about it, look at it from their point of view, look at it from the player's point of view, the coach's point of view, and try and take everything in and the situation. So rather than looking at a snapshot of a day. So if I give you an example, a physio started with us within the academy a couple of seasons ago. So he comes to me and goes, oh, do you think the under 13 should be playing on Monday and then again on Tuesday? So your reaction to that is you go, well, no. Because you assume that they're playing 90 minutes and playing football's hard work, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take a step back and look at the context, then you know that that team has got 25 players in that squad. So they might be playing 45 minutes on Tuesday, Monday, and then 45 minutes the following day, which then if you look at it from that point of view is a little bit more acceptable. And then you can see from the coach's point of view that they're just trying to get them game time against different opportunities. So what originally starts off as a confrontation with the coach, actually when you sit back, you can see it from their point of view and there's a little bit of an acceptance and there's an understanding of it. So not really rushing in would probably be the best advice.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I think many people, when they're especially starting a new job or starting a new internship, they should first learn what the culture is like, what the coaches are like and why they're doing what they're doing before starting to question it. And I think many times people just jump the gun because they want to seem innovative. They want to create a little niche or place for themselves within that specific club or that specific university here in the United States. And yeah. Sometimes you can rub people the wrong way.
The best exercise I was ever given to do was when I first started working with the under 18s. And I think I'd rub one of the coaches up the wrong way. to the point where he didn't talk to me for about 3 days. and the other coach just said, we were away on a tour. He said, you need to go home, write down what you thought of the tour, and then score yourself on how good you think you are at different things. So like nutrition, strength and conditioning, et cetera, et cetera. So he said, no, I don't want to see it, but just do the exercise. So I did it, and then I scored myself. And I start, nutrition, 7, strength and conditioning, 8. Bearing in mind at this time I'd been out of university for 2 years and this was my first job at a professional club. And I found it a couple of years later and I looked again and I was laughing at myself for scoring myself a 7 for nutrition because I know less than I thought I did, if that makes sense to you. And so I think you're at risk when you come out of university, like you say, you want to dive straight in, take the ball by the horns, be innovative. But unfortunately, you don't know as much as you think you do. And I probably think I know less than I did the year before each year because you meet new people, speak to new people and realize that you don't really know anything.
Yeah, and that's especially the case for me. Even though I've been doing this for quite a bit, not necessarily in terms of football, but talking to people like you who have been doing this for far longer at a professional setting is always humbling for me.
Thanks, I think.
Well, no, I just mean I learned so much more information than I would just reading studies, reading books.
100%. I think you learn far more from the conversations that you have. I speak to a lot of people and you go to conferences and presentations and talks, but you learn far more from actual just a conversation at a coffee break or from telephone conversations with people you've met than I think you can from a textbook, because you get the context of that person delivering it in their environment rather than this is what 20 untrained university students did kind of thing.
Absolutely. And this leads us perfectly into the final question that I end almost every podcast with. And it's, what recommendations would you have for young coaches coming out of the university beyond what you already gave that are looking to get into football, strength and conditioning, or sports science?
I'd say it's hard to get in. I think I was probably the last generation of people that prior to the influx of internships. So I was about because I was coaching at the time. I think you've got to realize that you have to pay the piper in terms of work experience. You have to be prepared to travel for an hour to go and watch a coach deliver a session, not speak to anybody, and then travel an hour back. You got to be prepared to invest that time. It's a very tough industry. I find it's an enjoyable one when you get there, but it's very, very tough to be there. I think you've got to realize what you want to do early on and then work out how you're going to get there. The people, look at the people that are in the job that you want to do and find out how they got there or what they did to get there. I was given I think it was for a coaching course that I did. They kind of asked, well, where do you want to be? Who's already in that position and how did they get there? So, okay, well, I want to be, for example, England manager. Well, how did the England manager get to that position? What coaching qualifications has he got? What experience did he have? So you're almost trying to follow in somebody's footsteps and never be afraid to ask questions, even if you already know the answer. Because it starts a conversation and a relationship, and it's a different idea from somebody else's point of view.
Yeah, and sometimes you think you know the answer, but the person will come back and you'll be mind blown.
Or the answer isn't what you thought it was in the first place.
Exactly.
So
what would be the best way for people to contact you if they have any questions or comments regarding this podcast?
My club email address, I can give you that. which is chris.wright, which is spelled W-R-I-G-H-T, which is at bcfc.com. I'll try and respond to everybody, whether it be a question, whether they agree with me, whether they disagree with me. And then I've got a Twitter account, which is Chris87Wright, I believe. Yeah, and they're probably the two best ways to get in touch if anyone's got any questions or anything like that. And if anybody's ever over from the States and wants to come into a professional football club, we're more than happy to kind of to open the doors and show. I've been fortunate when I've been over to the States that universities have let me in, football clubs have let me in to see the work that they do. So it's only fair that I offer to return the favor.
Perfect. And I'll be linking both your Twitter and your email when I publish the podcast, so that way they can have easy access to it.
Okay. Sounds good.
Chris, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. Thank you for sharing your information. Greatly appreciated. I'm sure the audience is going to greatly appreciate it. So thanks a lot.
Anytime. Really enjoyed it.
All right, Chris, have a great day.
You too. Take care.
Hey, guys. Thanks for tuning in today. I really appreciate it. Please take the time to head over to www.historicperformance.net for show notes and the resources discussed during the podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, make sure to leave a review and rating in iTunes. It really helps others discover the show. Thanks again, and see you next time.